Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Fuller, and my guest is Robert Maripol. And Robert, and well, Robert, as if people don't know, he's the son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. And over the past 3 years, Robert and I have developed a nice, friendly relationship where he comes on this program and does shows with me and talks about what's going on. And today we're going to have a really interesting conversation about the state of the country. And we discussed a couple of days ago about what we would be talking about. And what he emailed me back is really interesting. He said, the back-to-school chaos at the end of August and the beginning of September could trigger massive thought or another. Evictions may be skyrocketing. The pandemic will be raging. Feds will be occupying cities, and demonstrations will be continuing. Robert, that sounds like a pretty awful scenario.
Well, I you know, my fear is that we're entering a very, very volatile time, and that in some ways the first few weeks of August are prelude to it, that when the schools start reopening and we begin to get a taste of back-to-school chaos, and this is happening just after the two conventions, the sort of conventions, will have taken place, and the final throes of the election campaign will be starting. And I think Trump will be attempting to exacerbate the chaos, because I think that he and at least some of his advisors believe that the only way he's going to save himself is to create more chaos. And you know, there are all these parents who need to go back to work, or, you know, who've been somehow managing over the summer and then are expecting this into the breach and help them by providing essentially childcare during the day for the kids so that they can work. And but the schools can't really effectively reopen. I mean, they're going to try. And I think when the first teacher gets sick and the first teacher dies and all the other teachers see how dangerous what's going on is, either everything's going to go back to virtual or teachers are all going to go on strike. You know, when you're staring death in the face, it's very hard to keep doing what you're doing. And so I think that it's going to end up as chaos, and parents are not going to have what they need. And all of this will be taking place at the core of the election battle. And in the meantime, you know, the whole eviction thing is one of the things that people have to realize about the eviction moratorium is that it's not a rent moratorium. So anybody who's been paying, say, $1,000 a month, I'm just pulling numbers out of the air, for an apartment, and has not paid their rent for the last 6 months, has a $6,000 bill due, and they don't have any money. And you know, it's going, and the more the moratorium is extended. I just read that the Republicans' new plan includes an extension of the moratorium. The more it's extended, when it's over, a bigger bill comes due. So we have the mix. We have an explosive mix here. Plus, you know, one of the reasons all these demonstrations are continuing, aside from the fact that the demand for redress is perfectly legitimate, and is that there are all these people who are out of work. You know, they can be in the streets, and that's not going to change. So, you know, I put all that together, and the conclusion that I come to is while it's not necessarily going to be the case, We don't know how things are going to play out. We are facing the potential of the wheels kind of coming off the bus in the next couple of months. And that's pretty scary. I do want to mention one other thing I read this morning that I think is pretty interesting. And it's an idea that I had a while back, a few days ago, which is, what if the Democrats essentially say, we have a bill, we passed it 2 months ago, and that's our bill, and we think it's going to help with the problem, and we're not going to negotiate with you until you withdraw all your troops, the federal troops, from all American cities. And, you know, that's a very confrontational way of going about doing that, and the Democrats are quite capable at this point of doing that. But what I read today was that Schumer said they're going to try instead to insert into the bill this demand that federal troops have to identify themselves, have to drive in marked cars, can't arrest people outside of federal property. And so I guess the idea that I had in a more confrontational kind of manner a few days ago is now actually filtering, you know, it's not that I gave them the idea. I don't want to claim that. They've never heard of me. That this idea is evidently gaining some real currency. And because I think one of the things that is most frightening of all is the stormtroopers in the streets, grabbing people, throwing them into unmarked cars. And that's, you know, I think that has to be stopped. That's fascism, pure and simple, and it's got to be stopped. And the Democrats have the power to stop it now. Whether they will or not is a real question, because, you know, you and I have talked, Cynthia, many, many times. The Democrats really have the ability to blow things.
Yeah. You know, one segment that you kind of left out, and I think it's important, there's like 44, 45 million Americans with student debt, and their paying back is being deferred right now. But when it's mandated that they start paying back, even though they skip maybe 5-6 months, whatever, the interest still accrues. So, you know, that's no panacea. These people will be paying for life. You know, that's a segment of the population that if they were able to unite in some fashion, that could be a power tag also.
I think so. I think that, you know, we entered this crisis with no safety net. You know, with virtually no medical experts, and you know, the government had been so thoroughly gutted, and people were living so close to the edge, and the economy required massive overconsumption in order just to keep chugging along, and all of a sudden it ground to a halt, and you know, you have it's hurting tens of millions of people in so many different ways. You know, the only thing that I think has kept somewhat of a lid on the situation is all the stimulus, all those $600 a week checks and $1,200 one-time payments. And that has helped millions of people. But it appears to be coming to an end, and it's really, and even with that stimulus, the number of people in food kitchens, it is a terrible situation, and when people get put under increasing stress, you do have increasing volatility. So this is, I don't think, you know, the somewhat apocalyptic picture I'm painting I'm not saying that's inevitable. I'm not saying that's even likely. But I'm saying we're a lot closer to some of those situations than we ever have been in my, you know, in my lifetime. And I, you know, there are always tipping points. We don't know when we're going to cross some line and something is going to happen. Because, again, we look at the situation and we see how much has happened already. And so much of what has happened is stuff that we found virtually unimaginable just a bunch of months ago. And so what does that teach us about what might be coming down the pike?
So the all these coming into the large cities, do you think of Chicago 1968 on a grander scale?
Well, I don't know, because one of the things that's kind of weird about it, I mean, you have to remember everything that Trump is essentially a snake oil salesman, okay? So that when we heard that he was sending federal troops to Chicago, and, you know, there's something like 17,000, I think, Chicago police, that's the size of the Chicago police force. It's somewhere in the teens. I don't remember whether it's 13,000 or 17,000. Well, you know, okay, so if they're going to send federal troops in to help them deal with violence, well, then, you know, what are they going to send another 10,000? Are they going to, are they going to beef this up so that there's a substantial change? No, what we hear is that what Trump is doing is sending a couple of hundred federal agents. Now, that's enough to cause a violent confrontation, but it's not enough to actually solve any street crime problem. So again, it seems like the sending of troops is designed to cause more trouble, not to solve any problem. And that's what he's going to do in city after city. A few hundred troops there, a few hundred. Well, they're not really troops; they're agents. I don't even know technically what you call these people, but. It looks like, you know, the what you should probably call them is federal troublemakers, because that's basically what they're trying to do, foment trouble. And that's, I think, the principal tactic that is going to be used.
You still don't hear much from Biden. I think that's pretty frightening.
Well, you know, I think he's discovered that if he's relatively quiet, Trump just keeps shooting himself in the foot. And Biden, you know, Biden, as I've said on your show before, you know, he's got the charisma of a cardboard box. And he says things that are ridiculous. I mean, what did he come out last week and say that, you know, Trump was the most racist, you know, was the first completely racist president we've ever had? I mean, what, is he kidding? I mean, you know, all these presidents owned slaves. Woodrow Wilson was a flaming racist. I mean, you know, Princeton University is now thinking of renaming the Woodrow Wilson Center because of his racism. And so, you know, Biden comes out, and of course his aides very quickly said, oh no, you know, he made a mistake. He just meant in the modern era, not, you know, looking back. Of course there have been racist presidents before. But, you know, that's the problem that Joe Biden has, is the more things he says, the more risk there is that he's going to say something that's so really stupid that it's going to hurt him. So I think in some ways his relative quiet is kind of it's been a boon to the Democrats. I mean, that's kind of pathetic, isn't it, Cynthia? That the best thing you can say about Biden is that he hasn't done much damage.
Oh God.
Yeah.
He doesn't offer any inspiration either.
No, I mean, that's true. Now, another thing that he's done, and I think he's done it on purpose, is he hasn't given Trump a vice president to attack.
Right.
In other words, by naming nobody, there's been nobody else for Trump to pin a nickname on and really, you know, build them up as some super villain. And so I think that Biden is going to wait until the very last minute, you know, to the beginning, to just before the Democratic convention, to choose who his running mate is. And we'll see how that plays out, because depending, his running mate is going to have a record, and it's not clear, you know, everybody's whispering in Joe Biden's ear, and there's all these stories about how he's going more progressive in order to attract younger voters. But I think, you know, that until things actually happen and policies are actually made and a vice president is picked and we start seeing exactly what's in the Democratic platform, it's all public relations. It's none of it has any real substance. And of course, we also know that if Biden does get elected, and I would say at this point, it looks very likely that he will get elected, but things could change. If he does get elected, he's going to inherit a total mess. And how that gets corrected. I mean, we're going to be living with what's happened, country, you know, for years to come. We're in this. Things are bad now, and they're going to stay bad for a while.
Do you think they could get a lot worse?
That's one of my fears, that they could really get a lot worse. And one of the things I've noticed in, you know, I kind of channel surf the talking heads in the evening. I kind of go back and forth between CNN and MSNBC just to see what kind of mainstream liberal media is saying. And I've noticed a change in tone among the talking heads recently. It's not always there, but the change that I hear is there. A lot of them are talking about the fact that we're in big trouble and that things could get a lot worse. They're beginning to talk about Trump destroying the country, as opposed to just objecting to his policies. And I think that change is a reflection of people's fears, and is in line with what I've been saying about is this becoming a more volatile period. And that's, you know, I do want to say as a non sequitur that I do want to mention here, and there's a bit of irony in the circumstance, and that is that do we realize that if Trump had played his cards correctly in January, February, or March, essentially treated the virus the way Italy treated the virus, for instance, he'd be on the road to re-election now. It's a terrifying thought, but now it's too late. But he really shot himself in the foot. I mean, if he had done what the Italian government did, the virus would be under relative control now. The country would be slowly opening up. The economy would be improving. It would be in bad shape, but it would be improving. And we would have, and Trump would be treated as a hero. But none of that happened. And what's ironic about is that it took 150,000 American deaths for Trump to be exposed. I mean, it's amazing that that's what it took. But that seems to be the reality. I think that, you know, I don't know what the percentage of the American public is that are totally divorced from reality, but there are clearly a significant number of people who are, and it took 150,000 deaths to wake the majority up.
But there are still diehard Republicans that still think Trump walked on water. What do you say about that?
Well, I think that's true. There's a percentage of people, and you know, I think part of it is, you know, if you buy the snake oil, and you have two choices. You admit that it's snake oil, and you admit that you were a dupe, and you were fooled, and or you say, oh no, this snake oil is wonderful. This is the best thing that I ever took. It's making me feel terrific. Because you don't want to look like a fool. So I think that, you know, and the other thing is that for a significant, that, you know, this is a racist nation. And it was built upon African slavery and Native American genocide. And its colonial mentality is, you know, it's in its DNA. And so you have a certain percentage of people who are wallow in that racist ideology, and Trump panders to them. And I don't know whether, you know, they're a third of the nation or if they're certainly somewhere in the 30% of the electorate. Of course, you know, only about a majority of the people, you know, it's very rare for there more to be for there to be more than 50% turnout for an election. So that percentage of voters may be a much smaller percentage of the population, but it's still a very, very significant number. And they're not going to desert Trump because he's playing to their racist ideology. So I think the combination of not wanting to look like a fool for supporting a snake oil salesman and racism gives him his base. And then there are also the very wealthy people. I mean, you have to remember that the very top percentage has benefited massively from Trump. And, you know, if you have 350 million people in your population, even the top 1% is 3.5 million people. And if you're looking at the top 5%, it's 15 to 20 million people. So, you know, I think those are the sort of parameters of Trump's support. And you know, I think that one of the reasons he got elected was he's a pretty good snake oil salesman. But the virus exposed him.
Right. It would be interesting if things had turned out differently, how Hillary Clinton would have handled this. What do you think?
I missed. There's been some clicking on the line, so I need you to ask that question again.
Things had turned out differently if Hillary Clinton had become president. I wonder how she would have handled this.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I've you know, I heard we've had some speculation. You know, what would have happened if this had happened during the Obama administration? Of course, the Republicans would have all. Obama would have probably used the Defense Production Act in order to ramp up all the masking and testing, and would have probably put out a national mask mandate, and the Republicans would have organized against him, and we would have, you know, a culture war over this issue, and who knows where that would go. With Clinton, I think Clinton would probably have done similar things to Obama would have done. And of course, the Republicans would be organizing resistance against her, saying she was, you know, destroying our freedom. And that, you know, is so I think we would have a different kind of scenario. I don't think we would have the same kind of mass demonstrations. I don't think we would have federal troops going into cities, but I think we would have a real cultural struggle around the virus still. How, you know, effective any national program would have been, it remains to be seen in that context, but I think I can't help but think we'd be in better shape, at least with the virus. But, you know, the hope that we have for the future with an energized population of young people, and the Black Lives Matter movement, and all the environmental movement, and the kind of the interrelationship, the intersectionality of all of these things, which is galvanizing the population and presents us with the possibility of real long-term positive change, even though things are in very precarious situation now, I don't think we'd have that with a Clinton presidency. So while I think that the situation with the virus might have been somewhat better, and perhaps even a lot better, I think the long-term political prospects might not be that great. Mm-hmm. But then again, you know, that's the problem with speculation is you're speculating, and you know what I used to say about that kind of speculation, having grown up in New York City, is that plus 15 cents would have gotten me on the subway when I was a kid.
Right. So we have like a minute and a half left. How are you and your family doing during this crisis?
Well, you know, as an elderly person, I am pretty much, being very, very careful. So the result is that we don't get to see family the way we used to, and everybody is doing fine. But all of us that, I know people, unfortunately, who have died from this, not anybody in my immediate circle. But it's difficult, but we adjust as best we can. And I feel fortunate, that I have the flexibility to be able to isolate. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I like you, I have the flexibility to isolate, and I'm busy myself working on my radio shows, and I'm doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, good.
Well, our time is just about up. So you have been listening to Robert Maripol. This is All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. And if you like this show, like us or follow us on Twitter. Robert, have a great day. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Okay. Thank you for having me, Cynthia. Bye-bye.